So I'm just going to do one reading this morning. It's the classic reading we do from John 20th chapter, verses 1 through 18 on Easter Sunday. And it's, of course, the story of the resurrection. So now on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb early while it was still dark. She saw that the stone had been taken away. So she ran and she went to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved. And she said to them, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him." Peter then came out, and the other disciple with him. And they both went toward the tomb. The other disciple outran Simon Peter and reached the tomb first. Stooping to look in, he saw the linen cloth lying there, but he did not go in. Then Simon Peter came following him. And he went into the tomb, and he saw the linen cloth lying, and the napkin which had been wrapped around his head. It's not lying with the linen cloth, but it was folded up and in a place by itself. And then the other disciple went in. He saw, and he believed. For as yet they did not know the scripture, that he must rise from the dead. Then the disciples went back to their homes. But Mary Magdalene stood weeping outside the tomb. And as she wept, she stooped to look into the tomb, and there she saw two angels in white sitting where the body of Jesus had lain, one at the head, one at the feet. And they said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" And she said, "Because they have taken my Lord away, and I do not know where they have laid him." Saying this, she turned around, and she saw Jesus standing there. And he said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom do you seek?" And supposing him to be the gardener, she had said to him, "Sir, if you have carried him away, please tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away." And Jesus said to her, "Mary." And she said to him in Hebrew, "Rabboni," which means teacher. And he said, "Do not hold me, for I have yet to ascend to the Father. But go and tell my brothers and my sisters that I am ascending to my Father and your Father, my God and your God." And so Mary went and said to the disciples, "Told that I have seen the Lord." And she told them that he had said these things to her. We end with the reading from this first Easter Sunday. May God bless it to our understanding. Let us pray together. Gracious and loving God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart be acceptable in thy sight, my rock and my redeemer. Amen. So I just wanted to come down here and talk to you this morning a little bit. I'm reminded yesterday I was reading a little essay by E.B. White and Stuart Little, and he wrote Charlotte's Web and a lot of other books and essays. And he's watching his wife, Catherine. And she's in her last year of her life. She's older and bedraggled, and she's outside in late October planting bulbs in the garden. And he's just watching her frail body, and his wife, long life together, and could be the last year of her life. But she's still out there with her garden charts, and she's planting the bulbs because she's waiting for that resurrection, that new life. You know, so today is Easter Sunday. It's about the resurrection, right? And there are three opinions about the resurrection. It's a great mystery. We could talk about it for a long time. But I think of three opinions about the resurrection. I could talk about the resurrection of the body. I could talk about the resurrection of the spirit. I could talk, though, also about the resurrection of a new way of seeing the world. New eyes of the heart, awakening of the heart, awakening of a higher consciousness. So I'm thinking I'm going to talk today. I could talk about those other two on another date, but I want to talk about the third one today. The awakening to a new way of seeing and understanding life. And some of my inspiration comes from a documentary I saw 7 or 8 years ago when it came out. And my mother-in-law, who is a potter and an artist and a Quaker, told me about it at her Quaker meeting in Rhode Island. They were watching this documentary called I Am. It's the title of my sermon this morning. Anybody heard of it? Andy has. And it's really interesting because my mother-in-law, through the years, has just given me lots of spiritual books that have really helped me on my journey. And I'm not even sure she's always aware of the power of the books and things, ideas. But she, so she turned me on to this documentary. And it's by a famous movie director, maybe some of the younger people would know, Tom Shadyac in Hollywood. And Shadyac grew up in a kind of a comfortable middle-class family in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. You know, he had everything he needed, but it was a relatively middle-class life. But he went into, you know, got into movie directing. He was a comic. He was writing comedy scripts. He's out in L.A. He's struggling. But overnight, he becomes this incredible, successful director. The first movie was Ace Ventura with Jim Carrey. Anybody know? No? It was for overnight hit. He has tens of millions of dollars are rolling in. He is, and then several others, Liar, Liar, and Bruce Almighty, Evan Almighty. I mean, the list, The Nutty Professor with Eddie Murphy. The list goes on and on. So he's become one of the most popular directors in Hollywood. And he is a total American success story. He's got more money than you could ever use in several lifetimes. So what he did was, he says after that, in the beginning of the, he goes out and he says, go shopping. He buys a 7,000 square foot mansion in Beverly Hills. And then 2 years later, he sells that. He buys a 17,000 square foot mansion, 7 acres in prime real estate in Beverly Hills with two other houses on it. It's beautiful swimming pool, movie stars, as he says. He has the most expensive cars. He has a private jet. He is the total American success story, the dream. Well, you know, I'm a teacher too. So what students are looking for, right? Your fame and wealth. And that's what we're, you know, material possessions, things, right? Stuff. So he's got everything. But he says when he walks into the foyer, the entrance of that big 17,000 square foot house, and he realizes he is no happier in that moment than he was when he was a struggling, writing comic strips in LA, struggling and can barely put food on the table. And actually, he goes into some periods of depression. And what happens is, he's a thoughtful guy, so along the way, he's thinking along spiritual terms, but he's got all this money. And he knows people, you know, just down the street, a few miles away in different neighborhoods are, you know, homeless and scrounging through the garbage, and it just doesn't seem right with him. He has this terrible mountain bike accident. He loves to ride a mountain bike. He has a concussion so bad that he almost dies. So for 6 months, he's recovering. He wants to die. He's in so much pain. And he's sitting on the beach, writhing from this pain. And then suddenly, the concussion stops, disappears, the pain goes away. And he decides, gosh, I was so close to death. Now, if I'm going to die, what do I want to say to the world? You know, I'm a movie director. I can make movies. And he says, I've got to have a message. And I do have a message. I want to tell the world what I know. And so he gathers a film crew of four, and he goes around the world, and he interviews academics, religious leaders, poets, artists, sculptors, physicists, psychologists, all sociologists, so science and the humanities, a lot of different fields, prominent people. One of them was my professor, Boston University, Howard Zinn, who really changed my life. If you haven't read The People's History of the United States, you have to read it. People's History of the United States, Howard Zinn. But then there's Noam Chomsky, who was a linguist at MIT for 50 years. He's, I think, our greatest American public intellectual, a dissident, an activist, raising issues about social justice concerns and human rights issues all the time, and still going strong at 90. Brilliant guy. But then there's my favorite, Bishop Desmond Tutu. He interviews the Dalai Lama, and a range of poets, famous Coleman Barks, who talks about the Sufi, Rumi, Sufi mystic. So he's got two questions to ask these people that we don't usually ask. What's wrong with the world? What's wrong with the world that we live in? And what can we do about it? How can we change it? What can we do? Those are the only two questions. And he's going all over the world. And of course, there's a lot of humor in it because he's a really funny guy. And so he goes and he asks this question. And one of the problems is, he starts out, is the kind of worldview that we've inherited over the last 300 years, it's kind of a mechanistic universe. That we are objects that are governed by physical laws in space. You know, the whole Newtonian kind of worldview. That we're separate from one another. We're separate. So we can go off and build our own personal little empire and not worry about the people across the street or across the ocean. We're separate beings in this universe. And then we inherited the other part of it is the Darwinian idea of survival of the fittest, competition. And that's what we teach, competition. You can just have to, sometimes you have to step on people to get ahead. One of the things, one science, we have a misconception of Darwin, because in Darwin's Descent of Man, an 800-page text, he uses the survival of the fittest twice. He speaks about love and compassion 95 times. Darwin talked as much or more about compassion as he did about competition and survival of the fittest. So this kind of worldview that we're separated from one another is what we're living in, what we've inherited. But now it's beginning to change. We are evolving. Is everybody going? Okay. That's something I said, huh? We've inherited this view, but it's changing now. And actually, he does interview some religious leaders trying to make his point, but he wants to interview a lot of scientists, particularly in the world of quantum physics, which I don't understand completely, some of you do. But the whole notion that we're not separate beings in this universe. We're deeply interconnected and interdependent. There's no such thing as independence. Americans like to think we're independent. Nobody is independent. We are all interconnected and interdependent beings. And one way I could explain it is if I hold up a piece of paper, well, I do this to my students, what do you see when I hold this up? What can you see in this paper? What can you see? Demi? What do you see? Dorothy? You see a tissue, yeah? What else? It takes a while. Once people get it, they go, oh, it's paper. Yeah. White paper. Where does paper come from? So tree. Okay, now we got a tree. Got that paper. We got a tree. What else do we have? Leaves on the tree. What else? Okay, there are animals running around, scurrying around under the tree. What makes it possible for a tree to grow and be there? Water, sun. So here we're, what's that, David? Water and sun. And so then we start to look at everything that conspires together in nature. The whole universe, says Muir, the great, the conservationist in California, says you pick up one thing in nature and you realize it's connected to everything else. It's not possible for that paper to be here without the logger, his breakfast, his family, and so forth. We can trace everything in the universe to that piece of paper. And the same is true of us. We're so deeply interconnected with one. We're dependent upon the soil, the food that grows out, so we can, and our families and teachers and everything around us for us to be here. We don't exist as a little entity on ourselves walking around unrelated to other people. We're all interconnected. You know, there's the whole thing of the butterfly effect. The butterfly flaps its wings in Brazil, and we feel it here. Everything we're discovering in the world of quantum physics and what the mystics knew in all the religious traditions, the great mystics in Christianity and Judaism, but mostly even more so in the Eastern religions of Taoism and Buddhism and Vedanta and the indigenous cultures. You know, we're just starting to wake up in this developed world that we live in, this scientific, technological wonder world. But the indigenous peoples, the Aborigines, the tribes in Africa and in the Americas, they have this consciousness. They know how to live in harmony with the earth. They know that too much competition, as he mentions in the documentary, Tom Chick says, too much competition, too much stuff, this desire to have stuff, material thing, is a mental illness. And some Native American tribes have a term for it. Can't remember the name of the term, but that when you take too much, that's a sign of mental illness, too much competition. Because what they emphasize in most of these indigenous cultures is cooperation amongst the tribe. No, there are no homeless people in these tribal communities. Why do we have homeless people in the richest country in the history of the world? Because we have this mindset of separation. And once we start to see that we're all deeply intertwined, interconnected. So what I'm thinking about this morning is this resurrection to a new way of seeing, the real truth, the real beauty of this. You know, this Tutu, I love this wonderful book with Tutu and the Dalai Lama on happiness, because they're always laughing together. They're these old jokers. playful as can be. One's Buddhist, one's Anglican. But they see the world the same way. But he says, Tutu says, we come, the instructions are on the box when we come into this world. We have the instructions. We know how to live, but we don't read the instructions. We don't read it. It's very simple. Jesus said, the night he was arrested, he's in the upper room, serves the communion. He washes the disciples' feet. And what does he say? It's Maundy Thursday. Maundy means commandment. I give you a new commandment. What's the new commandment? What's the new commandment? To love one another as I have loved you. To love. And in the movie, the documentary, Shady X says, but it's not just sentimental love. Hugs are good. Hugs are great. The sentiment. But it's not just that. Love, he said, is Maya Angelou said, love is a force of nature. Love is what moves the stars. Love, it's like gravity. Love is what pushes the blood through the veins. That's what Maya Angelou was talking about. That's the kind of love. Love is what transforms society. You know, love is what helps people out who are homeless, who are struggling, who don't have a place to live, who can't, afford an education, who don't have medical care. What happens, though, in this interconnected world, when we come to this consciousness realization, we know that what happens on the other side of the world, the Syrians and situation and the refugees, just as an example, or the Rohingya in Burma being oppressed by the Burmese army, wherever it is, or the Uyghur people in China, or the Tibetans. And so wherever it is, it affects, whether these men, women, and children are suffering, it affects us over here. We know that we're connected. They're not just other people over there and some distance. We are one united family on this earth. So we're just coming. We're young. We've only been around 175,000 years, a 4-billion-year planet, right? So we're just evolving. We're coming out of this. We're coming into a new way of seeing the universe and the way it is. It's not, and it's okay. Science moves along slowly. It overturns things that it knew at one point. It will overturn this, and we're getting to see what the mystics in religions have known for thousands of years. We are part of one another. We are deeply interconnected. And when we see that, we'll know what we do to the other, we do to ourselves. So I pray that we'll be able to perceive this world differently when we walk out of the doors, see everything, every person, everything in nature is part of us. And then we'll treat the earth differently. We'll take care of this earth. We'll see this earth as sacred, a sacred gift. Everything we do. So that's it. God bless.